Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Let's have a look at the front pages first. The Sunday Independent: coalition on a collision course over builder tax. So we were flagging that yesterday. Possible tax breaks for developers seem to be in the ether, and that is can be an emotive issue for a country traumatized by developers. The Business Post is leading with a story on the whistleblower in the prison service. Their off lead is interesting: a radical overhaul of the planning system to limit judicial reviews. For example, an individual will now have to prove that the impact of a project on them before being allowed to appeal the development, which I would have thought is a no-brainer, but there you go. And the Sunday Times: new Irish battle with Elon Musk and WhatsApp, watchdog to examine Twitter layoffs and Meta hack. And that's the Data Protection Commissioner. Ireland is, of course, in charge of the Internet. That's our official designation. They're off lead: Catholic Order faces 131 special school sex abuse claims. This is the Irish wing of the St. John of God's. So just, we've heard a lot in the last few weeks about sexual abuse. That is 130 claims of sexual abuse against children with special needs, which is, it's unimaginable, isn't it? The Irish Mail on Sunday have two front pages, right, to accommodate an ad. So the outside front page is, "I'll allow all Gardaí have guns," and that's an exclusive with Leo Varadkar. The inside front page is, "Leo, I support arming rank and file Gardaí." So presumably if there was a third front page, it would have been watered down a little bit more. But that's the gist of it anyway. The Mirror pitch and tosser: this is the ongoing golfing career of the killer Brian Meehan in prison. He's now designing a new golf green, we're told, for his open prison. And he wants grass just like the world's top courses. The Sunday World: INLA plot, in inverted commas, to kill Burns. This is Sadie and James Jaws Byrne. And The Sun on Sunday is leading with a story about Conor McGregor, who is apparently grappling with planning chiefs over bats at the site where he wants to build luxury apartments. He's saying there are no signs of the winged mammals at the Dublin site, where he's already battled invasive Japanese knotweed. So there you go. He has his work cut out for him with invasive and endangered species. Our panel this morning: Suzanne Lynch is Politico Europe's chief Brussels correspondent. Lorna Fitzpatrick is advocacy and engagement manager at the NCBI and a former USI president, and we should say a member of the Labour Party. Lorcan Sir is a senior lecturer in housing at the Technological University of Dublin, and Dan O'Brien is chief economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Brian.
Dan, just before we get to the papers in general, you're writing in your column in the Business Post today about the outlook for the economy, and I wouldn't be starting the show with this if it wasn't a semi-benign outlook. So what's your read on things?
Well, the last time you were kind enough to invite me in at the end of the summer, I was very confused about the economy because things were happening that I've never seen before. Over the past 3 months, a little less confused and a little more optimistic, because most of the indicators from Ireland and to the east in Europe and to the west in America, which is important for us, whether it's to do with jobs or what factories are producing or how much consumers are spending or how much people are exporting and importing, most of these numbers have come in better than expected, or at least not as bad as expected. So there was a real fear that we were plunging into a deep recession, because we've had huge numbers of headwinds and shocks and uncertainties for the economy. But there's been remarkable resilience, and maybe the kind of resilience economies showed during the pandemic is there again. So I'm a little bit more optimistic that if we do have a slowdown, which is likely, it's not going to be deep. And the really positive part is that it may be a slowdown or even a mild recession without unemployment. So that's, I wouldn't bet the house on that, but I'm certainly a lot more optimistic now than 3 months ago, given all of the data we've seen over that period.
It's kind of incredible, isn't it?
It was really incredible.
And listen, I presume the worst thing about a recession, there's no good things about it, but the worst thing about it would be unemployment. If we dodge that,
absolutely,
we're not doing badly.
You know, if you go from 5% to 10% unemployment, you've got hundreds of thousands of people in Ireland's case who lose their jobs, who have big hits to their income, and that's much worse than inflation. We're all suffering from inflation, because inflation has eroded our real incomes. But if you lose your job and your income is slashed, that's a much more traumatic experience for a person or a household than suffering from inflation. So if we can avoid that, and you know, last week's labour market figures were quite astounding. We now have more people at work in this economy than we've ever had before. It's still growing. It's slowing, but it's still growing. And we have very low levels of unemployment. And if anything, we have too few workers because lots of restaurants, for example, don't open for lunches these days because they can't get the workers. So, you know, better to have problems of shortage of labour than to have too much unemployment. And that's where we are at the moment. And as I say, economies, including the Irish economy, have been remarkably resilient in the face of all of the shocks they've been suffering.
Yeah, just to come in there, Dan, I mean, some of the picture painting is playing out across Europe. But would you be concerned at all, though, that, you know, 10 years ago when we had our huge bailout in Ireland, it was all about austerity, and now countries across Europe, like Germany, for example, is just ploughing billions of euro into their economies to try and cushion the blow of the energy costs. Like, would you be concerned that this new kind of found, a complete opposite of what we saw 10 years ago, actually? It's like Germany has now discovered, OK, let's plough money in if our economy needs it. Are you worried that that would, though, be a warning bell for the eurozone economy? Or
look, there is the risk that, you know, energy supplies do end up getting cut off if something happens to the Norwegian pipeline for gas. You know, Italy is very close to having a real economic crisis around the area you've mentioned about spending more money than they can afford. There's a financial crisis potentially looming because interest rates are going up. We haven't experienced this. Like, there are so many things that keep me awake at night about the economy now. As I say, I'm not betting the house.
Could we see a financial crisis come out of private equity? That's what people are saying,
you know,
the next...
One thing that the financial crisis of 2008 taught me is nobody, not a single person in the world, fully understands how the financial system works because it is so complex and it has so many different parts. We've seen a crypto collapse recently. Now, that, thankfully, so far hasn't fed into other parts of the financial system. But there have been extraordinary things happening in the financial system over a decade of effectively zero interest rates. Now that that tide is going out, we're going to see who's swimming naked. And there is a real risk that something is lurking there that will cause financial crisis. So, there, you know, Suzanne's point about governments maybe overspending, financial crisis, energy crisis, there are a lot of things that make this turn bad. So, you know, we're certainly not out of the woods.
Suzanne, you ruined it all. We've managed to get a non-dismal view of things from Dan, but you brought out the inner dismal scientist in him. Lorna Fitzpatrick, does that hearten you to hear that?
Oh God, it was going so well. I suppose it is heartening in a sense, but I suppose when we think about employment, I suppose I always think of the types of employment that people are in, and the labour shortage that Dan has referred to is absolutely real. And then, you know, just from the job I'm in, I know that, you know, there's a huge amount of people with disabilities who are not active in the labour market, who could be active in the labour market.
Just remind us of the unemployment rate among people with disabilities.
For people who are blind or vision impaired, I'm 100% sure of the stat, and it's 24% of people who are blind or vision impaired are active in the labour market.
I imagine much higher than that probably across the whole disability population.
And we score very poorly on a European level in terms of employment for people with disabilities in comparison. So there's a huge labour market there of potential that is untapped at the moment because of barriers to employment and things like that. So they're things that need to be addressed. Also,
and actually, Dan, you would argue that a lot of that potential was unleashed in particular with regards to women, wouldn't you, because of working from home and everything?
There's been an extraordinary phenomenon during the pandemic that there's been this almost a 10%, it's just under 10% increase in the number of women. More than 100,000 women have taken up work since the pandemic struck. It's extraordinary. So it seems to have brought out, allowed women who maybe not have been able, because of childminding or house working at home, have allowed people to actually take a paid employment, more than 100,000. So a really, if there's anything positive to come out of the pandemic, it's that freeing of many women who may not have been able to work from home and do jobs to take up paid employment.
Okay, Larkin, you want to
It seems that Dan's point there about it better to have an inflation crisis than an unemployment crisis is a very good one. I note there, doing some research over the last few weeks, in the 1930s in Germany, the whole housing policy was controlled by the Ministry of Labour, not the Ministry of Housing. And the idea was there that they would keep rents down, keep wage demands down, and keep German companies competitive. That was the plan. So it was the Ministry of Labour who ran housing policy in Germany in the 1930s. The importance...
Much as we don't tend to take too many examples of how to run
even though we were
democracy
very similar.
From 1930s
yeah. We were
Germany,
very similar in many housing rights.
Their cabaret yes. and maybe the Labour the managing the housing.
Yeah, but the other thing is the importance of finance and the role of finance and how it's pretty much everywhere now and it's very complicated. And our housing policy is finance is so embedded in our housing policy. To date, from January to the end of October this year, about 30-odd percent of our housing output is going to be apartments. Nearly every one of those is going to be developed by international money. And the problem when you put all your eggs in one basket like that, you know, either the tech sector or a large proportion of our housing supply, which won't be for sale, it'll all be for rent, is that if there's a wobble there or if they find a better return somewhere else, that wobbly leg can be pulled from under the stool very quickly.
Yeah, and actually it's the subject of a spread today in the Business Post, is our property pipeline at risk of drying up? So just maybe you could explain this to me, Larkin. So we don't know anymore really if it's a good thing or a bad thing that these funds are here, do we? Because we don't want them to go away, as presumably you're just saying the figures are there in that quarter one to quarter three, 6,500 apartments, as you say, a third really of our housing output. Yeah, so if it's gone,
whether they're a good thing or not, it depends on what your strategy or what your aim is for housing policy.
Okay.
All the parties say that they're the party of home ownership. You can't be the party of home ownership at the same time as having 30% of our output purely rental and not even affordable rental at that. You know, it's mostly the upper end rental. I think there's a role for these funds, without a doubt. I think probably we've let them take over too much in that, you know, if you're having nearly every, none of the 20, there's been 23,000-24,000 apartments built in the last 5 years in Dublin or in Ireland, and almost none of them have come to the market for people to buy. So it depends, you know, from a government perspective, like, what's your long-term game plan here? Is it still to promote home ownership? Is it still to have, you know, property as an asset? Or is it to kind of reduce home ownership, which it looks like it is, given the targets in Housing for All, and promote these institutional investments? Very, you know, in the not too distant future, we could end up in a situation where people in their 60s, you know, where this auto-enrolling in the pension scheme so they can afford to live when they retire. You know, we could be subventing people in retirement in these institutional funds paying $2,500 a month. And that money, which is mostly tax-free, goes to Canadian teachers' pensions. So, you know, there's a certain irony about our pensions going to fund other people's pensions at the same time as we're kind of running down.
So what you're talking about is people who reach retirement without owning a home anymore. You use the word asset, and that can be a kind of a loaded, toxic-y kind of word for people because they think of financialization of housing. But actually, when you say asset in terms of the person themselves owning their home, it means an asset to see them securely.
Yeah,
into
what we
their
have
age,
is a system called asset-based welfare, which is effectively is we'll help you buy a house, and you know it there's no coincidence that you know when you retire your mortgage is paid off in or around the same at the same time, and the idea there is that you won't have accommodation issues when your salary goes down and you're on a state pension or on a lower private sector pension.
Yeah. So do you think it is desirable then for people to own their own homes? Is it?
There's loads of arguments for and against, but it is the system that we have, and we've had that system for the last 40, 50, 60 years. And I think to make a strategic structural change in that without any, what seems to be no game plan or no end goal or no clarity around it is really, really risky.
But is the structural change going to be made for us if these funds
structural change is already underway,
heading off, and 30% of what's being built is not going to be built by anyone else?
It's well underway, this structural change, all right, in terms of tenure and how people are going to live. You know, 30% of the output is going to be for rent. That's a huge change, not just in the way people live, but also on how people accumulate wealth.
Dan, you had also picked that piece.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunately, I took the dismal part of it. It's extremely well informed. I think it's a standout piece, Lurkin Allen in the Business Post, looking at the structure of the industry and looking at rising costs and that issue around financing. So the construction industry is getting squeezed because costs of materials are going up and getting access to finance because the financial system is under stress. Both of these things look like they're going to shrink construction. So whatever one thinks about different types of building, it looks as though we're actually going to get less supply, which is not what we need.
Yeah. Or the councils will buy them. I suspect that some of them will get finished out and local authorities will buy them for social housing or approved housing bodies.
This is happening to a large extent.
And the government are saying as well that they will finish them out.
Yeah.
They will finance
or approved housing bodies, housing associations.
Yeah. Lorna, would you like to see the funds go?
I'd like to see a house that people can afford to buy and live in. And at the moment, I think many people my age would say by whatever means necessary. And that's the reality of it. And I suppose, like, we're talking about this in a context of record homelessness figures coming out this week. You know what I mean? Like 11,000, just shy of 11,400 people. And so I think the reality is that whether it's investment funds or whether it's state build or whatever the case may be, the vast majority of people want to be able to purchase an affordable home. But that's where the affordable piece is key. And the private developers don't seem to be building homes at rates that are affordable. I'm far from an expert, so I'll take Lorcan and Dan's view on this one as to help inform mine. But I do very much think that local authorities and government building more housing is what the vast majority of people could afford to buy in comparison to what developers are bringing into the market right now. And so I don't think it's as easy as saying go home or get out. Go home, geez, that's an unfortunate term there that I've used. But I do think it's very much a case of trying to ensure that government building leads to affordable properties, or government planning, policy, decision making, whatever way it comes about, that it comes about to affordable properties that people can live in. And that's not the case right now. And the Taoiseach's comments last weekend around the grass isn't always greener has really riled a lot of people, I think.
Yeah. Why do you think it did? You've picked out a piece on it actually in the Sunday Times today. Dublin's unfair city defies Fine Gael rent claim.
Yeah. And the reason that I picked that one out, I think really is because there's lived experiences coming through from people in that and it's Matt McCann has detailed this today, as you say, in page 8 of the Times there. And like he's talking about how the average rent in Dublin is 2,258, and then goes on to show properties in Barcelona, in Berlin, in Vancouver, in Melbourne, some of them 3 and 4 bedroom properties,
with,
fully
with roof
furnished.
Roof terraces and swimming pools,
exactly.
Etc.
And like I know from people right across the country that's not the experience that they're feeling. And they're leaving. And like the quotes in there is in the headline of that, or the subline of that, is that people haven't looked back since they've left. And so I do think there's a piece that's out of touch with reality when the Taoiseach is making such comments like that. And I think it's really frustrating for people when they are trying to secure a future. And like, there's
now,
people who are delaying.
We don't have
up-to-date families.
Figures, but I've pointed out here before, the figures do suggest, though, that the net amount of migration out of this country is going down.
That is true.
And the figures the time, but who knows in the last year. Suzanne.
Yeah, just to touch on Dan's original point here, I mean, I think the specific accommodation crisis happening in Ireland reflects the fact that we have this contradiction that employment is so strong, the labour market. In the 1980s, the reason people left was that there was no employment, not that there was no housing. They couldn't get jobs. Now we have a situation where you have loads of jobs, you can't fill them, but you need somewhere to house them. And that's the problem. And then, just, I mean, it's hard to make comparisons, as you say, with figures.
Yeah, but as somebody who's living outside of Ireland,
I'm living
who has
in Belgium,
the European
Russellton,
view.
Absolutely, there's no comparison. Comparison in rental accommodation there.
So this is the hub of the EU, presumably of quite a lot of high earning people there and expensive lifestyle and everything.
There's a whole history there of hundreds of years of apartment living, where you have streets full of apartments. Like the way you have in Paris.
Owned
by a lot of Belgians, probably wealthy Belgians, actually. There's actually, as far as I'm aware, there is little or no tax that they have to pay on the rental income they get. But there's huge security of tenure for people. So you sign contracts and you might be in for up to 9 years. You can stay there. You can break it after 3 years. But I don't think Ireland will ever get, getting back to Lorcan's point, I mean, we're starting from such a different base that we will never have this. And even the standards of the apartments are much better. But I do think there is a problem in terms of asset price, to use that phrase, house property inflation that's happened since the pandemic. And we have to look at the reality.
And not just in Ireland.
Not just in Ireland, in America, in London, in Belgium, everywhere. Because the pandemic, the economic policies, I think, taken during the pandemic did serve to, you know, to bed down economic inequality, because the people in the more secure jobs just, you know, kept their savings, built up the deposit, and then that was fueling higher prices. The people on less secure jobs, of course, were the ones then who suffered more and didn't have that opportunity. And as we came out of the pandemic,
who were well looked after.
But I mean, in place, I was in America at the time, you know, we all got these checks from Trump and Biden. It wasn't targeted. So, there, you know, arguably well off people didn't need those checks.
I think it was probably better targeted than that in Ireland, in fairness.
One of the interesting things, Suzanne, is that the reason you find, you took all the countries you mentioned, nowadays we have the same players operating in nearly every country. You have the same funds, maybe under different names, but ultimately they all go back to the same umbrella company, and they're operating with the same lobbying techniques, the same outcomes in Belgium, in Denmark, in Spain, in France, in Germany. So you tend to get the same effects then as well, depending on the reaction of the individual government.
Can I ask you, Lorcan, about the... And I'll come back to you then, Dan. But just so in terms of... If you go back to what Lorna was saying, was we just want affordable houses and we don't care how, right? So... That story on the front page of Sunday Indo, and it was mentioned yesterday, I think, and also on the front page of the Irish Times, that this spectre of tax breaks for developers, if we want houses to be affordable, is that what we need to do?
Well, I think the first thing to point out is it's not the market's job to provide housing that's affordable, really. I mean, that they're going to provide housing to satisfy their shareholders. I mean, that's the name of the game for all those large companies or SME house builders out there. They're not in it to provide affordable housing. They're in it to provide housing that they can sell for the best price that they can achieve. In some places, that will be more affordable than others. So, you know, if you're somewhere very rural, the house price is going to be a lot cheaper than somewhere very urban and very desirable, not to say the rural
locations. So it's what the market can bear.
So the market, it's not the market's job to do that. So whose job is it? It's like, you know, the market has discovered that there's a sweet spot of about 7,000 to 8,000 houses a year that will come to the market every year, no matter how many we build, 33,000 or 133,000. And I suspect they're not going to build too much more than that. So to bridge the gap between the 7,000 and everybody else who needs a house, the state will really have to stand in some way, shape or form.
So is tax breaks for developers an effective way of doing it?
Tax breaks have to be really carefully targeted. And the problem with tax breaks, so they have to be very well written and very nuanced. The problem with tax breaks sometimes is that they can just effectively be a bailout for developers who've paid too much for the land and now realise because construction cost inflation they can't afford to build. So the next thing you go in and you lobby for a tax break.
So Dan, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, just to make the point that's been mentioned around here, that I don't think it's as well understood. Irish rents are absolutely insane. All of the evidence shows that from around the world, that we have some of the highest rents in the world. But we don't have some of the highest house prices in the world. And just as a report came out last week, it looked at 92 cities around the world. Irish house prices are about in the middle. So that may give some people some hope. It may, some people don't like to hear that. But we have really high rents, unusually high rents by international standards, but our house prices are not unusual.
There's no European cities in that survey, though, if I'm right. They were all American, American.
I just looked at the top 10. Sydney, Vancouver, Melbourne, San Francisco, Auckland and Toronto were all in the top 10.
Yeah, I looked at that. I don't think there's any European cities.
Well, there's certainly the UK regions and London.
I'd love to see a comparison to...
It's online if anybody wants to look.
I do think there's a point there as well that's really interesting in terms of the highest rent prices in Ireland and the highest rent prices in general, and then how we try to support people to purchase a house then when they're paying so much in rent. There's so much of people's income on a daily basis, on a monthly basis, going out on those essential costs that people have absolutely no choice but to pay, and then don't have that nest egg or don't necessarily have any form of savings that they can then use to try and get themselves on the property ladder. So I think
the government does have a range of schemes to help people with that.
And I suppose how effective they can be for different people are challenging. You know, like you look at HAP, for example, and there's lots of challenges in terms of that.
There's lots of problems with
HAP. But in terms of helping someone to buy a house, Lorcan, I'm right in saying that if you are a first-time buyer, you can help to buy.
But what you notice with them all is that none of them bring down the price of a house. They just allow Lorna or somebody else to borrow more money. That's effectively what it is. So it's all about helping people to afford what's on offer rather than making what's on offer more affordable.
Okay, but it might get them out of paying what Dan is saying are like bonkers rents.
Accumulating the deposit is the real problem for a lot of people.
But the problem with the housing assistance payment, the HAP, it seems to be, is that that is not really fit for purpose, or it's going to, you know, it needs some serious reform. That now a lot of residents are now in that private rental system, which should be maybe in the social housing. It's the lack of social housing provision. And then those people are getting HAP payments, which are then flooding into the private rental market. And there's
driving
a complete squeeze. And there's a complete squeeze there.
Okay. Can we just go back briefly to something that Lorna mentioned there? Leo Varadkar's comments that emigrants might not always find the grasses greener on the other side doesn't seem like that much of an incendiary thing to say in one way, but it clearly drove people mad. What did you think of that?
I spent most of my life as an economic migrant in six other countries. You know, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, sometimes it's tough. Sometimes you're homesick, sometimes you're not. Sometimes things are better, sometimes they're worse. Like, it didn't certainly strike a chord with me.
I do think, as far as I'm aware, he's specified Sydney and London. And those who, he said, or Sydney and New York, excuse me, Sydney and New York. So it is a fact that it's extremely expensive to live in Sydney and New York. That's an absolute fact. But it is less expensive, I'm experiencing myself, to live in a lot of European countries. So I do think it's important that they were the two places he mentioned.
But he also mentioned other cities that are like tier two or tier three towns and cities or something along those lines.
He said you'd have to go to a tier two or three city
to find something as expensive or affordable, depending on your lens, as Dublin, which isn't necessarily the case when you're looking at Barcelona or Berlin or Vancouver. Mm. You know, I don't think anyone would really claim that those are tier two or tier three.
I've lived abroad in various different cities, and like there's very few cities that don't have a housing issue or don't have a housing, you know, problem going on. I read Dáil debates from the 50s and I'm still looking at this stuff, you know, in 2022. But I think ultimately, though, I've never come across a city as expensive as here.
Really. And the rental crisis is an abomination. As Dan said, it's absolutely out of control. It's one of the worst in the world, definitely. I mean, there's no doubt about that, but particularly the rental sector.
Texture here says, perhaps I look at it too simple, but why doesn't the government give each council in every county the money to build social housing for the people like they did in the 50s, 60s and 70s and cut the big vulture funds out? Joe,
No, not really. And I kind of agree with that myself. But the process is, if a council has the idea to build social housing, there's now a four-stage, very convoluted and with subsections process that they have to engage with the Department of Housing in with plans, back with approval, in with plans, you know, whatever, four stages. And that can take up to 2 years to get approval. So there's very much a command and control.
We did see the minister apparently now is going to give the councils a bailout on land debt they might have
That's not a bad idea. So the old councils owe about €400 million. In the scheme of things, that's nothing. You know, so the idea of writing off the debt that they have on their own land is not a bad one. The problem is, if you give councils too tight a deadline, you'll end up with jerry-built or poorly built, you know, particularly if he's talking about using modular construction. If you rush that stuff, you end up with poor quality.
We'd like to believe that they're really good modular houses now.
Like all these things, it depends on how they're done. But you know, buying out, you know, getting rid of the debt that local authorities have is absolutely the right idea. And your texts are spot on. I think local authorities should be given the head and given targets and said, there it is, you've no excuse now, go for it.
And are they the people to build houses, are they?
Well, local authorities don't build, they'll
get a developer to build them.
They'll subcontract out to a local developer
who will build them at the same prohibitive costs.
I live in a Dublin corporation house from 1930. It was built by Cramptons, who were around until last year, the year before. That's the way it's nearly always been done, you know.
Yeah.
You'll have oversight from the council.
But is there a bottom line here that it's incredibly expensive to build now? So whoever's building them, it's going to be really expensive.
There are figures out there published by the Department of Housing. You can build a house for about, I think last year the local authorities have spent about $250,000 per house. So a lot cheaper than buying them and a lot cheaper than you might hear elsewhere. So it can be done.
Okay, before we leave this, Suzanne, you did pick out a piece in the Irish Mail on Sunday. Flagship scheme to renovate boarded up buildings fails to spark strong interest. So this is that there. The story is saying there isn't a huge take-up on the Croí Cónaithe scheme, which is about...
Yeah, it was kind of disappointing to read it, actually. So this was the scheme that was announced to much fanfare over the summer by Dara Bryan, and it was about trying to get investment and renovation into boarded-up buildings, commercial buildings, etc., across the country, which we all know in every town in Ireland. But the figures are that it's been very, 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 very slow take-up. And there has been some interest, but some counties there's been no interest at all. And it was the idea that people would get grants and it would include converting commercial maybe into residential.
The department are saying that it takes a while. There's back and forth about plans, etc. Lurkin, would you have any insight into... Like, we all agree, don't we, that it is a kind of a no-brainer to do this, living over the shop or doing up derelict properties in towns and cities, that the plan has now been extended to include cities as well.
Yeah, Dublin City Council did an interesting thing last week. A lot of people won't know this, but if you have vacant commercial property above your shop, you're entitled to apply for an up to 50% rates rebate on that, which was hardly an incentive for a shop owners to kind of do up their properties. So Dublin City Council have got rid of that, but the other 30 local authorities still have that. The Croí Cónaithe scheme, there's some parts of it that are good. The idea is to, you know, regenerate towns and sites and buildings in towns and not cities. But there are a couple of aspects of it that are unusual. Like, they look for, if you have a site, they're looking for a minimum of 4 stories on that site to be built, which is effectively apartments.
Really?
Yeah. And a lot of builders, particularly at the local level, you know, at that kind of level, they have no experience or interest in building apartments, nor might there be any market for that. So the site sits there empty, because it would be developed with a bit of funding from the Department of Housing, but with the requirement for a certain number of density, I think it's 35 or 40 units per hectare and minimum 4 stories. The local builder is going to say, I'm not going to apply for that, because if I build an apartment, no one wants to buy them here where I am, and I don't know how to build them anyway. So there are kind of glitches in it that could be ironed out.
Okay. Texter here, heartbreaking to hear the debate on housing. Son, 32, and look, this is a story we hear all the time from people. Son, 32, living at home in Dublin with his girlfriend, trying to save to buy their own home on a daily basis, losing all hope that they will ever achieve this, both on average salaries. Speaking of people's stories, Lorna, you picked out these letters to Micheál Martin. Tell us about those.
Yeah, so this was a piece that was covered, and it covers a couple of different letters. It's by John Lee in the Mail. I have the wrong one there. Apologies. But the story goes on to talk about letters that have been sent in to the Taoiseach, to the Taoiseach, and to many others in relation to housing. And there's one pensioner, aged 76, who says that they're worried about sitting at home in the cold and the dark this winter. And those stories are replicated by many others throughout that one piece. And there's one person who says something along the lines of, is the Oireachtas trying to push people into poverty? And that's the reality that people are feeling on the ground. So I know there's Housing for All. I know there's multiple new strategies and programmes, whether it's the scheme that we've just been talking about, whether it's the schemes to try and incentivise and support people to purchase housing for the first time, whether it's the energy rebates and all the different things that have been happening over the last number of months. The reality on the ground for people is still fearful is about turning on the lights and turning on the heating. And there was actually data released by the CSO this week, in particular around heating. For those who are unemployed due to long-term, unable to work due to long-term long-standing health problems. And 19.5% of people in that CSO data that was published during the week are more likely to be unable to afford to keep their homes warm this winter. And that was followed closely by people who are unemployed at 17%. So okay, That's the reality, you know, and they're the CSO figures coupled with those real experiences that people are sending into the Taoiseach about being fearful of turning on the lights and turning on the heating. And that's a sad state of affairs. And the piece in the paper actually doesn't know whether the individuals have had responses to their letters. Some have said that they've contacted ministers over 60 times and haven't received responses.
And that's in the Sunday Independent by Rodney Edwards, yeah. Suzanne, there's a poll in the Business Post today which kind of gives a slightly more nuanced picture than that, possibly, in terms of... It's basically a tale of two halves. Not that we're putting huge store in a poll, it's a snapshot, but for how it can be useful to us. That it's basically a half and half situation.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting. This is the latest Business Post poll, Red Sea poll, in the Sunday Business Post today. And one of the many aspects to unpick, but one is that the country seems to be very split. Like, and one of the analysts makes this point, are we getting a situation like the US or Britain, where you have, you know, two countries almost, or two very different visions of society and the way the country should be. So on everything, you know, the government performance on key issues, the overall running of the country is 48%. So nearly,
think the government think is doing a good job.
Well, helping people with the cost of living, 49%. So just half and half. Coping with the Ukrainian refugee crisis, 46%. But then, of course, no surprises here when it comes to health and housing. It's absolutely across the board. Only 14% of people believe that the government is getting the housing crisis sorted. And with healthcare, it's only 18%. So they are the two main issues. So that's interesting. And then there's more political.
I note Richard Colwell in his piece says that there's a kind of a disconnect there, or a cognitive dissonance, in the sense that half the people think the country, the government is doing a good job overall, but clearly are able to discount health and housing out of their thinking on that.
Because it doesn't affect them.
Give us just give us the state of the parties.
So the parties, I mean, look, with all these polls, Brendan, it's a half glass full, half glass empty. The politicians who are not doing well in the polls discount polls, and when they're doing well, they say, oh, the poll is great. But what this is showing is that Sinn Féin is still the most popular party in the country, but its support has fallen. It's down 4 points, and this is the first setback in more than a year of consistently
in this series.
And that's Michael Brennan writing about that. What's interesting, though, is that fall off is actually going to a lot of undecided voters. So the idea that it's who's picking up this. Fine Gael is up a little bit, but there is a suggestion that more votes maybe going from Sinn Féin, but people don't necessarily want to vote for the government parties either. They're looking for where to go with their vote.
OK, give us the other parties there as well, just to
so,
run down that.
Sinn Féin is down to 31%. Fine Gael is 24%.
Up.
That's up 3%, 3 points. And then Fianna Fáil is 15%. And then
which
the Greens
is down
one.
Down one on the last one. Yeah.
And the Green Party, 5%, still pretty low. And Labour, kind of depressing there for Labour. They're still at 4% as well. But those independent voters are interesting.
Yeah, OK.
They're up by three percentage points.
OK, so that's that picture of that. Just tell me that this was taken with 1,000?
Yes. These were about just over 1,000 people, and it was taken between last Friday week and Wednesday, an online poll. So there's usually a margin of error of around 3%± in these polls.
Okay.
That's generally it.
Okay. All right. Why don't we take a break at this point? Suzanne Lynch, Lorna Fitzpatrick, Lorcan Sir and Dan O'Brien staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us. Suzanne Lynch, Lorna Fitzpatrick, Lorcan Sir and Dan O'Brien. Dan, the Sunday Independent today, Owen O'Malley is writing the headline, Leaders Need to Make Sense of Anti-Immigrant Sentiment.
Yeah, I thought it was a good piece. Because Suzanne knows from her job looking at Europe and having lived abroad, you know, we're now pretty much the only country in Western Europe without a party that focuses on immigration as a negative issue. Which is unusual. Owen O'Malley, the political scientist, is wondering, could that change? And it's a good reason to think, why would we be an exception? But we still are. So I think it's important to put all of this in context that, you know, migration is a complex phenomenon. It has positives and it has negatives. And, you know, it's important that we don't shy away from saying that a big increase in numbers of people coming into the country increases pressure on, for example, housing. And it's part of the reason the rental market is as tight as it is. And, you know, let's not pretend that that's not the case. And you're not a fascist to sort of calmly say, yes, look, there are some problems with immigration as well as benefits. So I think he kind of encapsulates a calmer, more rounded view than we've often been getting.
And he's making that point about the so-called deplorables, that if you kind of ghettoise and kind of put down those people or whatever who have maybe what we might call legitimate fears, that there develops what he calls a representation gap,
where they won't
have a political party they feel speaks to them. Okay.
So Spain and Portugal were the last countries that didn't have parties that were specifically focused on anti-immigration, and suddenly they emerged. So, you know, people have to be able to talk about complex phenomena that have upsides and downsides without sort of this inquisition of being denounced and told you're some terrible person because you raise negative sides of a complex social phenomenon.
But this issue this week that we all saw, the protests in the East Wall were appalling, and they need to be called out at the same
time.
Well,
no, let's be careful here. I think there are two distinct elements involved here, and there are local people, and then there are clearly other elements coming in as they do into these situations. So, you know, let's not fall into the trap of the deplorables about everyone involved.
Absolutely. There are genuine concerns and that needs to be listened to and heard and acknowledged. But where information vacuums appear, they get filled by misinformation, and they get filled by people maybe overshadowing or coming in with particular viewpoints that are not those genuine questions or genuine concerns or the legitimate pros, positives or challenges. They are hurtful and can be hateful, and our government really needs to be proactive in trying to ensure that those information vacuums don't exist, so that they can't be filled by those people whose sole aim is to misinform and to I suppose
exploit the situation,
to feed into to genuine concerns and overshadow those genuine concerns. So there are two very distinct elements here, absolutely. But it's really important that we acknowledge that that's the case, and that we are proactive in calling out those who are not genuine concerns and that are not speaking on behalf of people in terms of trying to understand what the positives and where those challenges may exist, and that are really there with a single message, which is trying to divide. And we do need to call that out, because it's not appropriate, and it's not something that I think the vast majority of people in Ireland really stand for or believe in. But they can be pulled in and sucked in to really challenging narratives and really hurtful, hateful narratives when those information vacuums exist.
Dorkin.
Yeah, I think the first point to make is that these people who are coming from tents, none of this is any of their fault. These people are not at fault, and they're coming. The people down in East Wall were coming from living in tents, and so I think that point, politicians are kind of shy about making that point, that these are innocent people who are coming from a situation far worse than anything any of us in Ireland are going to experience.
And I think, in fairness to the people in East Wall as well, have moved the protest not to be outside the building anymore.
No,
when it was pointed out to them that this could be quite intimidating for the people involved.
A huge part of this is a communications vacuum, as has been said. I'm part of the expert advisory group with Catherine Day and David Donoghue to Minister Roderick O'Gorman about...
And ye did identify that this could become a problem.
Yeah, we gave a report to the minister last week, and we made several observations and some recommendations, but some of the recommendations were very much around communications and making sure there's no vacuum there. And communications isn't really the job of civil servants there. You know, that's not really what they've been trying to do over the years. So I think they need some serious help around communications. We also recommended that there's better coordination between departments. And it's fairly obvious that a lot of this has been dumped on Roderick O'Gorman's department, and it really needs to be better coordination. But the third thing that we said, and we said the report is available online, I'm sure, but we also said there needs to be a distribution plan around the country for dealing with people who need to be accommodated. And right now, it just seems to be wherever we can get accommodation, we're going to put people. So you end up in situations where hundreds of these poor, you know, asylum seekers are put into an old commercial building down in East Wall, and yet there are three counties and three constituencies in Dublin that have no what's called IPAS accommodation, no refugee accommodation. And the three counties are Carlow, Kilkenny and Roscommon, and the three constituencies are Dublin Bay North, Dunleary and Rathdown. Now, there may well be reasons for this. They can't find accommodation for them in Dunleary, Rathdown or Dublin Bay North, but they're also three quite well-off constituencies. And I think Pat Lee, who was writing the Irish Times yesterday about that there will never be a reception centre or a direct provision centre on Nutley Lane, which is, I think, where we are at the moment, and kind of inferring that there was, you know, a degree of snobbery around this.
But I'm pointing out, I think his kind of summing up of it was that in East Wall you get protests, but
here you get judicial reviews or goes to the court.
Yeah.
But I think they're definitely, and we recommended to the minister that we need to set up a distribution key, a way of making sure that all over the country, you know, this isn't lumped on communities, and there needs to be lots of advice, you know, prior to this. Now, no community necessarily has a right to be communicated, but that doesn't mean that you don't do it. I mean, you have to engage early and engage often with communities so you don't get these reactions and you don't give fuel to the far right fire, you know.
Okay, so in terms of your concerns about social cohesion and stuff that you expressed in that report, if we take it away from East Wall, and we've seen kind of mutterings coming from places like Killarney, for example, we've seen mutterings coming from Clare about the fact that they're going to need a tourist season come next year and everything. Do you see that becoming problematic?
I do, yeah. And I think we do, because it has been very... The way that these people have been allocated or dispersed around the country hasn't been really even. You know, there's places in Clare and in Kerry that have taken an awful lot of people. And then there's, you know, counties that have taken zero or no people at all. So I think there needs to be much better equity around that. But that part of that problem is because we've never planned for this. We thought this would never happen. This has never crossed our radar. So we never had what's called surge capacity, you know, if something like this happens. And it's going to happen again. And that's something else we said in the report. But we need that surge capacity. If it does, we can flick a switch and the plan kicks in, you know.
My understanding, and Dan, maybe you'd have an overview on this as well with your geopolitical interest. This is not now a temporary situation. This is now a permanent situation where you're going to have these levels of migration. Am I right?
Well, yeah, I think it is. Population just passed 8 billion recently. There are conflicts and there are also pull factors that people, you know, it's easier for people with mobile phones to tap into networks that traffic people. So there are lots of pull and push factors that are increasing migration. So, you know, it doesn't look like it's something that's going to change. You know, there are complex aspects to it that maybe we don't have time to go into, but clearly, you know, with Ukraine in particular, that has led to a massive number of people moving. Ireland has taken proportionately a lot more than other Western European countries in terms of taking people in. And, you know, that's something that, you know, I think was the right thing to do because it's very clear, you know, some countries it's less clear. And let's be clear about that. There are some countries where it's less clear that there's a case for giving political asylum and other countries where it's very clear, such as Ukraine, where there's a war going on.
But there's a huge issue brewing again with migrants coming over the Mediterranean, desperate migrants getting into the boats. There was a standoff last week between Italy and France. They have a new prime minister in Italy, very hardline, anti-immigration, Giorgia Meloni. And she refused to let a ship dock, and then it went to France. And there's now a big surge in migrants coming up through Serbia and around there. So a lot of countries, Austria, Germany, it's back on the agenda in Europe. And it's not just the Ukrainian refugees. And of course, most of Europe has been highly, you know, receptive to Ukrainian refugees taking millions. But there's another, a separate migration crisis that is brewing. The figures are way, way up. And there was a meeting in Brussels on Friday about it. So it's something to watch, that this confluence of events now, with Ukraine, the Ukrainian refugees and this fresh surge of migrants who are coming out throughout Europe and everyone's cost of living crisis, that politically it's getting right back up to the top of the agenda.
What is the thinking in Europe if this is the new normal?
Well, there's a big split because in countries like Greece and Italy and Spain, they're on the front line. They get tens of thousands of refugees arriving every... I mean, we don't... Compared to that, you know, it's because of their geography, coming over from North Africa. So those frontline countries. And they have been saying for years in the EU, we need solidarity. We should have some kind of redistribution system that when migrants come, we have a kind of a quota and each country takes one. But there's been a lot of resistance to that, particularly among Eastern European countries, Hungary, Poland, the more right-wing politically. Yes, they've been great on the Ukrainian crisis, some of those countries. But look, let's call a spade, everyone in Brussels knows, they say it themselves. It's because Ukrainians, they see them as closer to them, they're white.
White and Christian.
Yeah, that is what's going on there. So the EU is very split on migration, and it's one of those issues that's really under the surface with this new regime now in Italy, because Italy are so central to all this. I mean, and you can hear their argument, you know, why are they taking? Because once you're in the EU, you're free movement, and they're at the front line. So it's definitely something that's not going away.
You see, Lorcan, you wonder then, we had kind of relatively splendid isolation from all this for a long time, which to your point that we never thought about how we might deal with it. We're going to have to learn very fast how to deal with this in a civilised fashion, are we?
Yeah, and one of the things, I'm also on the board of the Irish Refugee Council, and one of the things that we're looking at the moment is the way to integrate migration, and particularly these, you know, emergency migrations, into our planning system. So you start with the, you know, local area plans, development plans, regional plans, and the national planning framework, that we integrate this, our preparedness for this, into our national planning, which we don't do at the moment. I mean, at the moment, despite the fact there are 70,000 Ukrainians here, and the vast majority are going to stay here because Zelensky doesn't want them coming back for a long time yet anyway, they're not built into our housing for all targets, for example. They're just totally ignored, as if, you know, they're going to house themselves or if they're going to be no part of this. And they have to be built into that. And I think they have to be built into our national planning framework with our immigration or, you know, projections and all that. So we need to prepare for this because it will happen again. And how do you do that? Well, you plan for it and you put it into our formal planning system.
And that planning when it comes to services as well, you know, not just around housing, GP and medical care,
teachers,
all
that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
Dan, the World Cup. We can't get away without mentioning it. You've picked out Éilidh Shohanlon. Moral accountability is a whole other ball game.
Yeah, I thought Lush Hanlon has always sort of got an interesting take on things. And, you know, this week there's been an awful lot of discussion around the World Cup, the idea that it was given to Qatar. You know, this is a country that I think there are around 300,000 passport holders in Qatar. It's a village with no sporting tradition. It's already got dumped out of the World Cup. It should never have been given to it. But there are, you know, there are not black and white issues around this. It's a global game. Where does the game go? You know, where do World Cups, where do Olympics go in the future? So I just think she has a sort of shades of grey piece that's worth reading.
And listen, if we're going to start getting like fussy about who we do business with, et cetera, et cetera.
It's a very good point, exactly. I mean, sure, the World Cup was in Russia in 2018. We just had the Beijing Olympics in China. I mean, there are hypocrisies all over the place, you know,
What I find, I'm absolutely mind-blown about this, and I hold my hands up, I had no interest in FIFA, and I really don't continuing either. But, like, the president of FIFA is rerunning uncontested after what has been continuous discussions over the last number of weeks and months about the challenges around corruption and things like that, that is within the institution or the organisation, whatever it is. I'm just baffled and blown away by the fact that everyone is facilitating and continuing to engage in that, you know.
It seems that the chairman of FIFA is not chosen by pearl-clutching Western liberals. Apparently, there's a very broad number of countries involved.
Yeah, Western liberals, all the rest of it.
And apparently, there's been a hint of corruption in the organisation in the past.
Yeah,
we're told.
But that's the thing. Like we can laugh and joke about it, but the reality is that this is serious, you know, and the system is being propped up by people facilitating that corruption. And that just blows my mind. And look, I can be a left-wing young activist, whatever you want to call me, but to me, that is absolutely mad.
No, I wasn't calling you that.
No,
I was just making the general point
on Twitter.
he's not necessarily speaking to
my
us,
audience,
you know.
No,
and even
absolutely.
when all that mad speech last week, you know, it didn't go down well here, but there's a whole other world out there, apparently.
Declan Lynch, briefly. Yeah, Declan is always an interesting person to read as well. So Declan Lynch in the Sunday Independent has a good piece about Qatar and I didn't know this, but you know they've banned beer in the stadiums. Mm-hmm. So you can't have beer except in the corporate box.
Yeah.
So their principles are
wishy-washy
as our own.
Okay, Suzanne Lynch, Lorna Fitzpatrick, Lorcan Sir and Dan O'Brien, thank you very much. Just wanted to say we have some new information from the Department of Housing here. So the Croí Cónaithe cities, we hear there's been a significant uptake in the first call for applications. A second call has been issued on it. And the vacant property grant has had 420 applications since it launched in July. OK, thanks to my panel.